You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 119.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
So you've reached another Local Maximum. Good to be with you this week. All of these probability and Bayesian-related episodes are generating so much interest. So I've got a really great guest for you today. We aren't going to sidestep the question of Bayesians versus frequentists. We are going to deal with it in a more direct way, in a more head-on way. We're going to have a discussion about it, how, you know, most of academia and even some of industry is still very frequentist. Why is that? So I'm really excited and how do we change it as well? So I'm really excited to talk about this today. Today's sponsor is Brilliant, the creators of fun and interactive courses to help you learn about math and science. Check them out through the link for today's episode to help out with the show as well. That's localmaxradio.com/119. Brilliant. Now, today's guest wants what we call Bayesian inference to cease being the unwanted and ignored child of a well-rounded general education in probability theory and statistics today. He is a professor of science and technology at Bryant University and also the author of Statistical Inference for Everyone. Brian Blaise, welcome to the show. You've reached the Local Maximum. Welcome.
All right. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you. I thank you so much for reaching out to me because, you know, you said, I see you've done so much work on trying to get Bayesian inference into the popular consciousness, into academia, which where it's so badly needed. And so I'm really glad to have you on the show today to talk a little bit about your experience. Yeah, and you know what? I was looking at this last night, and I was looking, and this might surprise you. I was looking at my top 10 most popular shows. You know, I don't, podcasters do this. They're obsessed with download numbers, okay? And so I ranked my shows, which is now 117 shows as of now. This is going to be show 119, but 119 isn't out yet. And the top 10 of the top 10 shows, three of them have Bayesian in the title. And I think I only have five with Bayesian in the title or Bayes in the title. So that surprises me. That tells me something. I don't know what that tells me. That could be, I mean, I am a Bayesian, so there could be multiple explanations for that. But and it's a small data set, but at least Bayesian doesn't turn people off. I'd say that.
Right, and maybe your listeners, at least for me, I can speak for me. That was certainly one of the things that caught my eye because I was just looking around on different podcasts. I just stumbled upon your podcast probably maybe about 2 weeks ago, maybe three, like right around the time that we went into quarantine.
Right.
So I was kind of looking at things and I saw you had a Bayesian come up. And then there were a few of them like that. And so I started listening. And one of the things that struck me was, in a sense, how practical you are, like in terms of your explanation, you're not coming at it from like a high math sort of perspective. It's very, you kind of grounded in applications. And I thought one that I think that's somewhat rare, but it makes for a very nice kind of discussion or a very nice presentation of the material.
Yeah, I really like doing that. It's funny because I'm the sort of person that really jumps off the deep end with the math. Like I could do that, but I gained some self-awareness about it at some point and was like, okay, I could keep doing that, but let's kind of bring it back to a practical thing. And by the way, where are you that you went into quarantine 3 weeks ago? I've been here for 8 weeks more.
Actually, I think I'm probably just losing count of the weeks, honestly. So yeah. Actually, I think I probably went into quarantine somewhere around mid-March because it was pretty much the end of our spring break. And that was, so I'm in Rhode Island.
Gotcha. And every day seems the same these days.
Yes.
All right, so let's get into it. So Bayesian inference, big topic here in the Local Maximum. I know you have a lot to say about it, some of it which might be new to my listeners, but I want to start by pointing out that your book is called Statistical Inference for Everybody, or for Everyone, and not Bayesian Inference for Everyone. I use the term statistical inference a lot, but I haven't explicitly defined it. So before we get into Bayesian versus frequentist, why don't you tell us, what do you see as the goals of statistical inference? When someone's saying they want to do statistical inference, what are they trying to do?
Well, I think mostly it's trying to make the use the best information to make decisions. This may include models, but a lot of it has to do with quantifying effects and their uncertainties, and that's a major point. And I also find, kind of more generally, that the idea of statistical inference is to properly structure one's thinking. So I think of it almost philosophically in that way, to be able to recognize and avoid common cognitive biases, to make sure that you're thinking properly and using the evidence in a non-biased way, to be able to you update your beliefs based on new information, and that sort of thing. So I think of it both in terms of the kind of applications of it, but also somewhat more generally in terms of how should you properly think about things.
Cool. So you talk about the disconnect between the way statistics is taught and the way it's used successfully in practice. And it sounds like Bayes' rule is a big part of the picture here. What do you think that disconnect is, and where does it come from?
Well, it's actually really interesting. So my background is in physics, and statistics is actually not a part of standard physics training, at least not in the kind of standard application in terms of p-values and hypothesis testing and so on. You do a lot of probability theory, you do statistical mechanics and things like talking about how molecules move around, but you don't do statistical tests, for example, and there's not like a class that you would take. And that disconnect actually goes back a couple hundred years. And I learned a lot of this from E.T. James, who wrote a lot of articles on this back in the 70s and the early 80s.
And, yeah, maybe we want to go into a little more detail there, because I talk a lot about Bayesian, the history of Bayesian thought. And I talk about Bayes himself, Laplace, which you should talk about too. I talk about... Then more recent stuff, but I actually haven't gotten into James too much.
Yeah, well, James kind of, in a sense, led the revival back from, before. So like the rough history is that we have Bayes' rule that's named after Reverend Bayes, who had written it down, but had never published it. It actually published after he died. Right. And Laplace, in the late 1700s, early 1800s, independently derived the same rule. And he derived a lot of things. And he was kind of the Newton of France at the time. But he was the one who actually applied probability theory across a wide range of applications, from sociology to physics to all over science, geology. And so he was the one who kind of put that kind of firm theoretical foundation. It was after he died that there was kind of a backlash against a few of the ideas that were the foundation of probability theory. Much of it was this idea that probability is a measure of your subjective assessment of a proposition. So something like.
Which is sort of the way I think about it.
Right, right, exactly. And that would be the kind of the Bayesian way to think about it. And in fact, the word Bayesian has become so toxic. I generally just refer to probability theory because it's really hard for someone to argue against probability theory. But there was this backlash mostly from mathematicians who didn't like that kind of subjective aspect of it. So they tried to make it more palatable as a theory. They formed essentially an objective version of this, which defined probability in terms of long-run relative frequencies, where you could kind of count things. And when you're counting things, then there isn't this kind of subjective prior. And that procedure was really pushed a lot by Fisher, who was a geneticist. And he came up with many of the kind of statistical tests and the frameworks, the frequentist frameworks that we've come to hear about in most textbooks. All the while, kind of the probability theory, kind of Bayes' rule formulation was kind of percolating in the background. There were some physicists who were still using it. It was used by Turing in World War II to help crack the Enigma code. There was a book a while back called The Theory That Would Not Die.
Yeah. I don't know if you've gone back, but we actually, we talk about that book in episode zero of this podcast.
Oh, I might not have missed, I might not have caught that one, but yeah, that's an excellent book. And that really traces the history nicely for that. And E.T. James goes through a lot of it as well, and is a little bit more technical. And one of the things that was, you know, kind of shown, I'd say probably from the 60s through the 70s or 80s, is that you could derive a lot of the kind of frequentist tests from a Bayesian perspective, most of the time essentially assuming no information, so essentially uninformative priors. So when you didn't know anything else, you could pretty much count stuff. And that's what you would get. And that's why Fisher would use it a lot, because he was a geneticist. He was talking about real populations. He was talking about counting things. And so his methods work really well in that context. But they don't tend to work really well if you have kind of prior knowledge, or if you have kind of a theoretical framework that you're basing it off of, which is why a lot of the kind of the Bayesian revival has been led by astronomers, because they're in the case where they have kind of theoretical expectations, kind of prior information, and they're often dealing with a small amount of data. So like they might, you know, you're analyzing, say, neutrinos from a supernova, you might end up with 12 data points. You might be observing the night sky across, you want to do it for a month, and weather keeps you from doing that, you only get a week. And so you need to be able to use all the information that you can, but you also often have, you know, some kind of physical models that's going to help you know, guide your thinking.
So you've got to kind of squeeze as much information as you can out of the small amount of information that you have.
Right. Yeah. And not throw away anything that you do have. I mean, if you know the structure, the statistical structure, say, of the background radiation, you can use that knowledge to help subtract it out to help get a good signal. So, and there was a paper by Tom Laurito that I found was really nice and clear, essentially highlighting that advantage of Bayesian methods. It was called something like Laplace supernova, and it goes through some of the history a little bit also, but and derives, you know, Bayes' theorem on a foundation, but it also applies it to problems in astronomy.
So yes, this is really interesting, and so you mentioned before this disconnect, which I want to dive into a little bit. So this sounds great. We can make more inferences from less data. This seems like a superset of frequentist objective methods. Why this disconnect?
Right. Well, I mean, in some sense, why is a disconnect continuing? Right. You know, I guess that's the question. I mean, once it's made clear that you have multiple methods and they may, and you can apply them, say, to the same problems, the question is why would you always choose the best one? I think there's still, I would say there are kind of four reasons that I would think that why there was this kind of a disconnect. There's still this aversion to the kind of subjective priors, and I think this is overblown for the most part, but we can get back to why I think that one is not a problem. That conditional probabilities are inherently unintuitive. And there, I think there, you know, people might be worried about teaching this and the hurdle that you have to get students over in order to have conditional probabilities be intuitive. There is a definite perception that the Bayesian approaches require some kind of advanced mathematics. That I've heard from multiple people. But I think, you know, probably the final reason is what I call inertia, and the inertia can be, you know, as simple as we've always done it this way, you know, why change? But the other thing is that sometimes you are training students. So I'm speaking in an academia point of view, training students for certain, kind of official jobs. This could be like med school or actuarial school, and they have certain tests and expectations. So you might ask a statistician who's teaching statistics to an actuary that, you know, why do you teach the frequentist method as opposed to Bayesian? And they'll say, well, that's what they're going to be tested on. And so we have to, I mean, we can't really just change the vocabulary immediately.
But one of the things I got out of the Theory That Would Not Die book is that the one of the first areas in the private sector to employ Bayesian methods was actuaries.
Yeah, yes, it is. It still is there, but it does seem to be a minority still.
Oh, interesting. So, and, right. So they still talk about, right. you know, hypothesis testing right. and things like that.
Yeah,
so
they do. And yes. And I think a lot of that has to do with that they don't often have good kind of models of what's going on. And so you're relying primarily on sampling.
Right. Right.
And when you do that, then the frequentist methods work.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, I never deny that they work, but let's right. we can talk about that in a little bit.
Sure.
But I want to dig into some of the things that you said. First of all, like, are conditional probabilities really unintuitive? I feel like, okay, like, you know, given that, I'm having trouble thinking of an example off the top of my head, but it doesn't seem like it's that bad. And even if it's like hard for maybe a high school student to get over it at first, it seems like a worthwhile thing to understand. Like, given that that I could do this, then it becomes more likely for this other thing to happen.
Right. I mean, my response to it is really yes. It's valuable. There's a lot of things we teach that are unintuitive, and it's kind of our role as teachers to be able to get people over the unintuitive part and to apply it, but also to recognize that if it is unintuitive, then you're going to be making bad decisions because you're not going to be thinking through. And one of the classic examples that's given generally to med students is this is the result of a medical test. And so, and this comes out obviously in, you know, now when they're doing tests for corona, like how good are the tests, and so are false positives, false negatives, and so on.
Sure.
And there's a classic example of like you have a rare disease, it could be like a 1 in a million or something disease, 100,000, whatever it happens to be, and a test that's like 99% accurate, and you test positive. What's the probability that you have the disease? And a lot of people say, well, it's a 99% accurate test. I'm almost certainly likely to have this disease. And it turns out that your intuition fails, especially in the case of rare diseases, because the false positive rate ends up dwarfing the true positive rate. And that comes out in an application of probability theory or Bayes' rule, if you want to go there. And you end up with actually a tiny chance of you actually having the disease, depending on how rare the disease is.
Yeah, another one that's been circulating online recently was like the governor of New York put out this thing. He's surprised that something like 2/3 of people who are being diagnosed with COVID-19 were staying at home. But as someone pointed out, well, we have to look at, you know, what was the, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're more likely to get it staying at home. I mean, we have to look at the percentage of people who are staying at home.
Right, right. Yes, exactly. And I think it also comes out in, people saying like the number of people who test positive for this disease seems, you know, really, really high. And then when you look at the actual, the way the test is done, sometimes it's picking up the exposure to other coronaviruses, like the common cold or other.
Yeah, I was wondering that, like, is it like, yeah, there could there be like a false positive on this test?
Absolutely. And it's been shown that does exist.
Yeah. I mean, that's, that is concerning. I asked about that online and like, just a question, like what's the false positive rate on this test? I think I said, I wasn't trying to be, well, Twitter, everyone like assumes you're trying to, you have some kind of a, but I basically got responses saying like, no, there is no false positive.
No, that's just,
Well, I was just trying to figure out what was going on, which 2 months later, I still haven't figured out. I want to tell you about a new sponsor for the Local Maximum that I'm really excited about. I checked out some of their courses recently, and I think you should check it out too. It's called Brilliant, and it's not like most online courses or all the other online courses that you've taken. You're not going to have to sit through long videos and download PDFs and all that. This is a highly visual and interactive way to learn concepts in math, probability, science. I always say this, the most important part of learning a new concept is being able to get a good intuition for it, to understand what it means and what's going on. And, you know, I talked about the pitfalls of memorization recently. As you'll recall, if you use Brilliant, you'll understand. If you want to dive deeper and actively learn some of the concepts that I've introduced here on the Local Maximum, whether it's logic or probability, and all the way, you could also learn something up to like group theory or quantum mechanics, which I haven't talked about as much on the show. I think we did have quantum mechanics once, but anyway, Brilliant is a great way to go. You want to go to brilliant.org/localmaximum to check it out. The first 200 who do that will get 20% off. The first five, I'd be worried for you, but the first 200, I think you can get that. So go on brilliant.org/localmaximum, grab that discount. Remember, it's called Brilliant. You can take the courses on their website at brilliant.org, but it's also an app as well, so you can get it on your phone or tablet. Remember to sign up. Go directly to brilliant.org/localmaximum to get the discount or find my link at localmaxradio.com/119. So, okay, the next one I want to dive into is subjective priors. We've talked about that a little bit. We've talked about that actually quite a bit on the show, but there's definitely more to get there. So yeah. What is, yeah. Okay, here's the Bayesian argument, which is like, hey, we already know a lot about this problem, so why don't we use that and then take this data and then figure out where that leads us. But I guess the argument against that would be like, why not just let the data lead us wherever the data goes, and, you know, don't bring your prior biases into that. So how would you respond to that?
Well, okay, so it's actually an interesting question, because I think that's at the heart of the kind of aversion to subjective priors, right? It's like, you know, oh, you're just injecting your opinion in this. And then when you look at it in detail, you find that the frequentist methods, they also have a subjective component to them that is worse in many ways because it's not explicit. It's hidden in the procedure itself, in the way that you approach it. And one of the I had to learn all of these things kind of afterward, you know, after, you know, hearing people talk about statistical tests and so on. And so when I was looking into this, you know, so certain things kind of perplexed me as I was kind of learning. And, you know, so like, what does a p-value really mean? How do these statistical tests actually work? There was a paper, I think in 1976 by Lindley, where he looked at an example of flipping a thumbtack. And this is kind of a play on the standard problem about a biased coin. Like, you know, you flip a coin, you know, 10 times and you get like seven, you know, heads and three tails. Is that good evidence that this is a biased coin?
I don't understand the thumbtack. Like, how do you?
Okay. So with a thumbtack, the reason why he chose it is because there's not an inherent symmetry to a thumbtack.
Right.
So if you flip it, it'll either have its point being down toward the table or it'll have its point up.
Oh, right.
But you could totally imagine grabbing a random thumbtack and one of them might be a little longer, one of them might be a little shorter. It's hard to imagine that with a coin. Like, how do you bias a coin? It's a lot harder, right? So I think it did it deliberately to kind of choose a system that didn't have an obvious symmetry. So you didn't already think it should be 50-50, like, and that it could really literally be almost anything. And then he quoted data. So he said, you know, he has 12 data points where he flipped it, and they were like, you know, up, 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 down, up, down, up, 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 down, right? And that was his 12, right? And in that, there were like three downs and nine ups, right? And he goes through the kind of frequentist approach about like, what does a p-value mean in terms of the probability of seeing more extreme data? So what he showed was that if you think that the person was flipping 12 times and you calculate out the p-value, you get something that is less than the 5%, all right? But if you imagine that the person was flipping until they got three down, because it happened that the last one was a down, right? If you flip until you got three down, then you calculate a different p-value that's above 5%, and so you wouldn't rule out the no.
What's the hypothesis that they're testing?
Yeah, yeah. So basically, is this a fair attack, right?
Yeah.
And so depending on what you thought, what you imagined the experimenter was doing at the time, your result changed.
That's weird.
Yes. And because what you're doing, you're imagining a different population.
Yeah.
And that's all what frequentist effects do. They always imagine some kind of sampling population that they're comparing to. And so when I saw that, I was like, that's amazing. I mean, and it shouldn't, you know, that it shouldn't happen. And then what makes it worse is he said, you know, what really happened was not that I flipped until I got 12, and it wasn't that I flipped until I got 3 down, is I flipped until the coffee was done.
Okay, what does that do?
And so, which means, well, what it means is it means that the frequentist approach can't even use the data. Wow. Because there's no population you could compare it to. It just obliterates the entire process.
I've never heard of this thumbtack experiment, surprisingly. And I look into this stuff. So I'm going to definitely read this.
It's one example of what's called the optional stopping problem. And it's a known problem in frequentist approaches that doesn't infect the Bayesian approaches.
Yeah, if I were to approach this as a Bayesian, that would not be a problem.
Wouldn't be a problem. Right. Yeah, exactly. And this is another reason why astronomers have come to this, because, you know, they might plan to do one thing, but the weather has other ideas. And so then their final result is different. And depending on what population you imagine it came from, you might get a different result. Now, so when presented with this problem, I asked statisticians, you know, frequentist statisticians, about what do you handle with this problem? You know, some responses were, yes, it should depend on what the experimenter was thinking at the time, which I find I can't believe. And the other problem is that they'd say something like, well, it's only 12 data points, so you really can't conclude anything, except for there's the fact staring at you that if you imagine a different population, you get a statistically significant p-value, which means by their procedure, you should be able to say something. So that doesn't work. That doesn't work either. But that was one of those kind of turning point papers where I read that and I was like, this is kind of crazy in a way that this would happen, that on such a simple problem. E.T. James likens it to, he talks about the Galilean method for problems like this. So you take a situation and you bring it down to the smallest problem that you can, that, like, you know, really low number of data points, so that way your intuition should tell you what's the right and wrong answer. And so he did this for a number of different cases, and one of my favorites there is the case with so E.T. James has a paper I think or somewhere in the mid-70s, in 72 maybe, or 75, called confidence intervals versus Bayesian intervals. And he goes through a number of simple examples, but a few kind of jumped out at me. One of them was a confidence interval calculation that you could show that the 90% confidence interval was wrong 100% of the time on this data set. That you just look at it and be like, that's just flat out wrong. Yeah. It's just out of the range that you know it could be. And that was remarkable.
My experience is that if you report confidence intervals, everybody thinks it's a Bayesian interval anyway.
Yes, that's true. And under kind of certain symmetric cases, that's the case. In the example he showed, it was a truncated exponential. So it was like a device that after a certain time would start failing. Before that time, it would have no failures, and then there's a critical point, and then it has like an exponential distribution of failures after that point. And you're trying to estimate the time point of the of when that kind of, you know, trigger for the failure starts to happen.
Okay.
But you can't observe that time directly. You only observe the subsequent failures.
Okay, I can see that problem.
And so I think he had something like there was some, like, you know, chemical or something that you know, slowly, you know, worked its way out of the system, and once it was gone, the thing started failing, right? And you only saw the failures, but you wanted to know how long did the chemical last? And then he had a 3 data point system, essentially, like the time of failures were like, you know, 12 hours, 14 hours, 16 hours kind of thing. Right. And so you immediately know that the failure had to have happened before 12 hours, because that's the first data point. Right. And he shows that in this case, the 90% confidence interval is all like past 12 hours. It's like 12.1 up to 13 or something like that. And you're like looking at the data and you're like, wait a minute, you know, we know it can't be that. And it turns out that there's this funny subset problem that happens, that it's true that the long run relative frequency that would happen. But in certain weird subsets, you know that that gets violated, and it turns out that you can recognize those subsets from the data itself. So he kind of zooms in on the smallest possible problem to highlight it, where your intuition says, okay, you know, I know which method works and gives a reasonable result. And you might not see that when on a bigger problem. And so that's, you know, that was his kind of way of showing, you know, the differences between things.
I'd like to dive into that on my own time, maybe, because that sounds like a great example to repeat. I want to ask another question about subjective priors, because that's, it's a benefit of Bayesian analysis, but there are also dangers. I mean, one of the things I point out, for example, is if I decide what the answer is going to be before the experiment and then run the experiment and give you my decided answer, that is valid in terms of Bayesian's equations, you know? So where, if you're going to be, if you're going to do Bayesian inference, I feel like there has to be a set of guidelines on coming out with these priors. Are we good at that at all? How do we approach that?
Well, it'll depend on the situation for sure. There are some cases where we know at least the range of what the value of a parameter should be. We know, like, for instance, if we're talking about estimating an infection rate, we know that has to be positive for sure. We know it has to be bounded right by some, you know, physical and biological.
So we have the space. A lot of the times I like to say, like, the space of hypotheses you're working in right often tells you a lot about, you know, what types of probability distributions you want to look at and right all that stuff.
Exactly. And then you try to use as wide of a prior probability distribution as you can get away with that's still consistent with your knowledge. In some cases, you can make that formal, like we're called maximum entropy priors, where you're given some information and you can show empirically, you know, objectively what the prior should be for your parameter given, you know, what you know about it already. But in other cases, it's somewhat subjective. But even your choice of model, like, there, you know, kind of subjective choices come into play at every stage of the analysis. It's not just at the prior, right? So it's also in the likelihood, right? It's also in the models that you're choosing. And so just because you say, oh, we're going to start with an objective prior, that might not actually mean, you know, a whole lot if lots of subjectivity in the likelihood, and everyone has this problem. This is not unique to Bayesian approaches. This is true in frequentism. Sure. I mean, you have to have some kind of model of the system.
Sure. So it's, you pointed out that you found this stuff through your work in physics primarily. Without, I'm sure you took statistical, you know, you learned statistical inference through physics. Like, I learned it through machine learning and not through a formal stats course, which I never took an actual stats course, only intro to machine learning, intro to natural language processing, stuff. So data mining. Was that what enabled you to stumble upon this realization? What do you think would have happened if you took the stats course?
Yeah, it's a good question whether I would be frequentist today or not. You know, if I had taken the stats course earlier on, I started off with my PhD. I have a PhD in physics, but my dissertation was in computational neuroscience. So I was overlapping a lot. I was going to a lot of talks in biology, and so they would put up these plots with histograms, and they put little stars over some of them to say that it's significant. And I was always like, I kind of vaguely know what they mean, but I didn't know kind of quantitatively. So I spent a summer just kind of, you know, going through it, and that's why I bumped into all these different issues. And then I found that most of these techniques seem to be mathematically equivalent to the Bayesian techniques if you assume no other information, essentially uniform priors. You can essentially derive all these kind of statistical tests. which is, you know, when I wrote the book, Statistical Inference for Everyone, I kind of, that was the approach that I did, mostly because I was trying to convince frequentists. So I didn't want to do kind of a full out, you know, Bayesian in your face kind of presentation. I wanted to show how it was accessible, how we could deal with a lot of the same problems that you are already dealing with in stats one class, but that you didn't have to, you have a kind of a frequentist approach. And that was kind of my proof of concept.
Yeah. I think a lot of people who take these stats classes, like, just say, okay, this is the method and I learned it and I can just go with it. But I think once you start asking too many questions, you start thinking a little differently.
Well, one of the funny things I think is, so I had said that, one of the objections was unintuitive conditional probabilities. And after kind of the serious response of saying, like, you know, this is important to learn and so on, I have my kind of snarky response, which is, well, you know, ask your students to define what a p-value is and then tell me whether that's intuitive or not. Because most you know, students will say it's the probability of the null, which, you know, all those statisticians are like, no, it's not. And, you know, because the students are thinking mostly in a kind of a Bayesian way, I think, whether they realize it or not. And then the p-value is not that. And so it's pretty unintuitive. And I even have to look up the definition from time to time because it's that unintuitive.
Right. Okay. So I wish the world was Bayesian. It isn't. I feel like there are, you know, there are a lot of people who are not Bayesian. They do great work. And sometimes I find I have to read papers or results where I kind of like, I cringe at the terminology, but I don't want to dismiss it. So for me, there's kind of a code switching that goes on. How do you handle this?
Yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that, When they talk about p-values, I just imagine, okay, they're assuming a certain probability distribution and they're looking at tail, you know, areas. It's like a Bayesian, you know, I usually think of it as kind of just, you know, a Bayesian with very few assumptions. Like that's and no kind of, you know, models behind it. Or I think of it as like, okay, if all you have access to is counting, then that's what you get, and it's about it's about the same. So I often think of frequentist methods as basically being a subset of the Bayesian approaches in that way. And it's true that many of them are easier computationally to do. I mean, if you're going to do a full Bayesian analysis, sometimes the computation takes a long time. If you're doing like an MCMC and so on, and there may not be that much benefit to doing that on some simple systems. Right. If you have a hierarchical system, you know, Bayesian all the way. But if you have just a kind of, you're just doing essentially a linear regression, essentially, you may as well just use the solution that's already been found.
Except like when I'm working in a Foursquare's code base, when there's like MCMC libraries built in, I'm like, yeah, go for it all the time.
if they have it. Yeah. So for sure.
Yeah. it sometimes does take a long time. It depends on what the problem is. But I found if it's like a one-dimensional easy problem, the MCMC stuff is also easy. So
yeah, that's true. And sometimes even just brute force is easy in that case. Like, you know, if in a 1D problem, it's actually easiest just to run out the parameter in that one dimension, and then you're done. And that's pretty simple, you know, straightforward.
Yeah. The one thing that makes me nervous, like I have not really read any, you know, medical papers or studies, very few before this whole pandemic situation. And now I've, you know, been curious enough to look at a few of them. And it makes me nervous when they have these small sample sizes and they're talking about p-values. And I'm just like, no, I kind of want to see, I kind of want to see prior and posterior here.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that, and I think you're right to be nervous in those cases.
That's not to say the studies are wrong. Like there are a few that I saw. Well, there's one in particular I'm thinking that I read before this pandemic where I was like, that's too small of a data size. But then I realized that the effect was pretty large, and then it turned out that it was correct. So
Effect size is actually more important, I find, than p-values, honestly. You know, it's funny because I thought when this whole pandemic was going down that I'd be reading a lot of the papers and diving into the data and things like that, because it's kind of my wheelhouse for that. But I found, at least psychologically, I just didn't feel like being in COVID-19 24/7 in terms of my thinking.
So
I've been like, you know, okay, I'll look at things here and there if there's something I want to look at, but it's for the most part, and there's that. And the other thing is the lack of testing and has pretty much led to data just being pretty unreliable for the most part. And that's much harder to deal with. And I think one has to be very careful about how you craft your models in the case where you can't trust the data set that you handed.
Yeah. Well, if you don't want to talk about COVID-19, let's talk about marketing for a second. Because I was in, I worked on an attribution product for 2.5 years, which is trying to tell companies, you know, whether their ads were actually driving people into stores.
Right.
And so we moved from basically a frequentist model to a Bayesian model. It seemed like sales and maybe the industry was more frequentist. And so what they were doing was, it was like, give me a p-value on whether there was an effect, and then give me a point estimate of the effect. And it was not workable if we wanted to give them reasonable information. Once we had like prior and posterior, okay, like as we get more data about your ad campaign, we're more and more certain about what the effect was. And you could like see, like, you know, here's the probability that it actually was zero and so on and so forth. And again, like a big effect is a lot easier to detect than a small effect. That's another thing I had to like tell people over and over again, where it's like, they're like, how long until we know whether the ad worked? And I'm like, well, it depends. Did the ad work really well, or did it work kind of well, you know?
Right.
And so, but one of the frustrating things about that is, yeah, like the, I almost had to believe, you know, which is why after 3 years, it was like, okay, that's enough time working on this. But I almost had to believe that the guy writing the check for these ads, or guy or gal and their analysts, they care about, you know, all this data. But the problem is the people it goes through, whether it's like the company's sales teams and the ad agencies and all that, they sort of don't want to pass along all of that statistical knowledge. And so it was kind of a game of telephone that get very frustrating.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess there's, one has to be able to communicate the end result of any statistical analysis in a way that people can understand it. And I mean, it helps if they have some basic knowledge of it, right? That's always helpful in terms of kind of education. You could essentially, you know, call it a p-value, even though it's not really in terms of, if you just look at, you know, posterior areas and stuff like that.
When we were on p-values, they were totally interpreting them as Bayesian confidence intervals. But what we ended up doing was we took our problem, like we had a sophisticated MCMC Bayesian model in the background, but in the end, we just took our probability distribution and we gave them median 5%, 95%.
Yeah.
There's your range.
Yeah, and that's credible in the goal.
It worked reasonable enough. Yeah.
Right. Right. And the median is definitely, you know, definitely better.
Yeah.
To use for that.
Yeah. But I still think like they could have made better decisions if they want to know, if they wanted to dive into, you know, how the distribution works a little bit more.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the nice things actually about the Bayesian approach is that the posterior includes all that information if you want to dig it out.
Right, right.
You know, you don't just have to go with the median. You can go with something else. You know, you can look at, you know, various areas. You can do other things, especially if there's like multiple variables. Then you really have a way to kind of explore it. And that gets around like the kind of multiple comparison problem. That's a real problem with frequentist methods, and there are, you know, various techniques to deal with that. The Bayesian, you know, hierarchical methods seem to deal with that without any issues.
Right. I mean, that's another thing. This model was like, you're trying to look for a number, a positive number, essentially. But some spaces are much more complicated. Like,
right.
if you're code breaking like Turing, it's it's still it's a it's well it's a finite space, but it's way more complicated than right. You know, it's you know, there could be so many different configurations, and each of them are connected to other configurations
right.
in kind of a Rubik's Cube type fashion. And so you know, there's a lot more sometimes searching the, that makes searching the space much harder. Mm. That's where the problem is there, I think.
True. You know, my focus has been a lot in being in academia is like trying to see, are there good ways of teaching this to people so that way when they do work for companies and where that they're able to be receptive to this vocabulary. And so that's one of the reasons why I wrote that book, was so that kind of show as kind of proof of concept, this is how you would approach an intro class with, from a Bayesian point of view.
Yeah. And you said that like people associate Bayesian, inference with advanced math. And is yes. that really like, it's actually, I find that sometimes even going through a very simple Bayesian example could get, it's not advanced math, but it kind of could hurt your brain a little bit, even like the, even the medical example. It's right. strange how it seems it's simple numbers and yet it doesn't, you have to be organized in order to get it to really
work. Right. That's true. It is a little bit, you have to be a little bit detail oriented, but I think what, you know, what my impression is that the people who are saying that it involves advanced math are saying so because the first time they ever saw Bayesian analysis was in graduate school, when they saw it all like with all the extra proofs and connections to limit theorems and everything else.
Measure theory.
Yeah, exactly.
I love measure theory, but you know, but yeah, not, you might not want to start with that.
Exactly. And so they, in their head, they associate the kind of Bayesian approaches with these kind of more advanced things, not recognizing that their frequentist classes in graduate school also had all of that, which of course they're not covering in their undergraduate classes, and they don't recognize that kind of disconnect. They never saw it at the undergraduate level. I mean, I went through like to try to see like what textbooks cover intro stats from a Bayesian point of view, and I found two, and only two in all the books I looked at. So mine would be number three. One of them is the Think Bayes series by Alan Downey. He's at Olin College, and that's an engineering school. So that was a very accessible, but more in terms of programming. So they actually ties it with computation really right from the beginning, and that's kind of part of their in terms of their curriculum. The other one is one. By Barry, Donald Barry, I think is his name, and called something like The Bayesian Perspective or something. And that's from 1995, and you really can't get it anymore. Even on the book, it says it comes with a floppy disk. So
when did you find a floppy disk? You know, you can still get on Amazon a floppy disk thing that connects with a USB into your
That's your astounding.
Well, I know. Well, I've been transferring mini DVs all last weekend, so I've been looking into all this stuff, and I might even need to transfer a few VHSs. It's a good quarantine project if anyone's looking for one.
Do you have the hardware to do it?
Yes.
Like, do you have a VHS player that you can use to do the transfer?
Yeah. Although I was using a mini DV camera, which I think you actually need the camera because there's no deck to plug it in. So that was pretty straightforward. But I tried plugging the VCR into the mini DV camera into the computer, and something got all like messed up in the way. So today I got a cable in the mail from Amazon that will hook up my VCR directly into my iMac. So we'll see how that goes.
That's one of the troubles with technology is you do have to kind of keep migrating it every so often, or you just lose it.
Even some file formats that were like uploaded previously no longer work,
typically try to use text formats as much as I can.
Yeah. But with video, I don't know. I
mean, you can't do video.
It's in .mov. Hopefully that'll be good for a while. I feel like the things now will last longer than maybe things 10, 15 years ago, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll we'll see. All right. Your book is that available hardcover only or online only, or is it hardcover as well?
So you can, I did it through CreateSpace, which I think the move to Kindle Publishing now, Kindle Direct. So you can either download like a PDF from my website, yeah, or you can go to Amazon and order a paperback version
cool.
of it.
So you can get PDF, a that's another yeah. format that is not going to go out of fashion anytime soon.
yes.
All right. So cool. So I'm gonna link to that. localmaxradio.com/119. We're gonna have a lot of links today. I could already tell. So let's end. You know, when people think of statistics or data science or probability, I think the public usually doesn't associate the word imagination. And you've used that term, so that interests me. As like an important ingredient to the work that we do. So why is that? Tell me a little bit more.
Yeah. So I gave a TEDx talk a couple years ago about this and talking about how your lack of imagination can kill you, and but you can be saved by math. And the idea is that you know, probability theory or Bayes' theorem is more than just mathematics, that it really is a way to structure your thinking. And one way to phrase it is to say that that your beliefs in any claim at all should scale with how likely that claim is before you see any data, how well your particular model might, you know, fit that, your explanation, how well that explains the data. But it also should be scaled down by the number of plausible ways that same data can be explained in other ways. And that's where a lot of imagination comes into play, is kind of imagining alternatives to
yeah,
your observation.
People don't like to do that when they've already made up their mind.
That's true. And I think this is one of those kind of cognitive biases, right? You know, kind of the confirmation bias, where you look for things to confirm what you already believe, and you tend to ignore the others. Or even if you don't ignore the others, you don't actively look for alternatives. And this is, I think, probably—
Once you think you've found the answer.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think probably my training as a scientist is what's kicking in here, where the scientific methods really encourage the idea of, you know, don't trust your initial thought. Think of many ways that this could come out, and try to find ways to rule those out. And so I give a few examples in the talk. One of my favorite examples, though, mostly because it is utterly trivial, but it's this kind of like, once you try to practice this thinking. So I was with a student working on a project, and I looked up and there was a clock on the wall that was broken in some way, like the second hand was kind of ticking erratically, and I just and the time wasn't really correct, and so I looked at it, it's like, oh yeah, that clock's like totally broken. And the student was like, no, I think it's actually clicking out the right amount of time, it's just doing it inconsistently. So it's, you know, it's clicking a second and then waiting for three, but then jumping 3 seconds and waiting for two and then jumping two, but like on average kind of essentially. And I looked at it like, no, I don't think so. So we had like kind of two claims. We had the observation. And so I, you know, put a dollar down and I said, I think I'm right. And we both pulled out our smartphones and sat there timing this broken clock for a couple of minutes. And it turned out I was wrong. It was actually clicking out the right amount of time. But I was glad to be wrong and to lose that dollar, because it meant that I, you know, got to practice, you know, this way of thinking, but also that I knew one more true thing in the universe and one fewer false thing. And I think, and I was willing to have my belief challenged on the spot and be shown that I was wrong, like right then and there, even on something trivial. And I think that kind of attitude is important. And it's encapsulated, that part of it is actually encapsulated in the denominator of Bayes' theorem. It's essentially a sum of all the different ways you could explain the same thing. And that's where, you know, so I see it kind of in a larger philosophical sense, more than just the mathematics.
That's a great story. You know, one thing I find when I'm struggling with a problem, and for some reason, you know, I'm struggling with it in my head, so I'm not going through Bayes' rule and all that formally, but then eventually if the problem gets so intractable, I'm like, all right, you know what, Max, you got to sit down. You know how to do this. You know how to use Bayes' rule. And so I say, all right, what's the first step? Well, the first step is lay out all the hypotheses that you could think of. I guess in the scientific method that I learned in school, it was come up with a hypothesis. But now I'm like, no. Come up with
many.
Lots of hypotheses. I find that once I go through that that particular exercise of laying out all the hypotheses, I find like I almost don't have to go through the rest of the actual math. Like the answer almost falls out from that. Right. You know, surprisingly, a surprising number of times.
And it also helps. I mean, to bounce your ideas off to someone else, and they can think of other things. Yeah. So you're using their imagination as well. And you're right. I mean, I think people use probability theory or Bayes' theorem informally all the time. I mean, we're constantly evaluating claims, situations, inferring about our environments and so on. We just don't recognize that we're doing it. And it's only in those cases where I think our kind of intuition fails or this problem becomes too complex that we really do have to be a little bit more systematic about it. But we do it. We use it all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I almost feel like, I mean, some people, a lot of people are irrationally fearful now of a lot of stuff, but I almost think like fear is a evolutionary thing to make sure that we get the important hypotheses in there right. in the short term so that we know if there is danger, then we've considered it.
Yes.
All right. So on that note, the book is called Statistical Inference for Everyone. Maybe you could tell us a little bit like where we can get the book and also where else we can find you online.
So the easiest place to find me online is at bblaze.github.io. And you can get copies of the book there. You can, my blog is there, and I need to post a little bit more, be a little bit more active, but there's a lot there. Okay. It's kind of my playground for working out.
Well, post about the local maximum.
I will.
All right, great. I'll link to all that, localmaxradio.com/119. Brian, thanks for coming on the show. Any last thoughts on our discussion today?
No, it's been fun. Thank you so much for having me on here.
Thanks for coming on. And look forward to getting this out.
Excellent. Thank you.
All right. Definitely check out Brian's book, Statistical Inference for Everyone, at our show notes page, localmaxradio.com/119. And also our sponsor, Brilliant. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. Remember to check out the website at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and more. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe to The Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account, @MaxSklar. Have a great week. Feel the power.